Good morning.
Morning.
How was the party?
Great.
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 Some fingers?
I want to hear great.
Great.
Okay. We need 2 more minutes, so we want to ask you some questions before we start. Who of you is using Scaleout File Server already? And some of you?
A few hands.
In production? More than, okay.
you do not count.
Storage spaces? Come on. 2 of you.
2.
You
so more Scaleout file server than storage spaces. So if you're using Scaleout file server then without storage spaces, are you using traditional block level storage in the back end?
Are there other possibilities? Did I miss something?
Yes. Might be too long, isn't it, at the party? You forgot all the stuff.
I was not long at the party, no. So who is using storage spaces, Scaleout file server with traditional block storage? Who is doing that? Are you? No one? Okay.
We should be ready in a few moments. Seconds. So who is excited about the storage spaces, Scaleout file server situation we have right now in R2?
Oh, are we excited?
Yeah. Of course. But okay. Are we ready?
Ready?
Okay. Ready? So now, again, officially welcome. Glad you made it to the first session after this heavy party yesterday. Glad we made it. And Carsten, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah. Good morning. My name is Carsten Rachfall. I'm from Germany. I think you will hear that in the session. I'm an MVP for Hyper-V, and I'm doing a lot of storage spaces project in enterprise and service in the service provider area. These guys love storage spaces because they are not so expensive than traditional storage, but we will talk about that later. I have a blog. It's hyper-v-server.de. I'm blogging in Germany. Apologize for that, but we have a lot of Hyper-V in Germany, and I'm on Twitter, Hyper-V Server.
Thanks. My name is Michael Riefli. I'm working at IDnetics in Switzerland. I'm focused on cloud and data center. Mainly, I do Hyper-V storage, Azure Pack, networking stuff, and automation. I'm also an MVP for cloud and data center management. You can reach me on my blog, where I blog about my fun and pain sometimes, and also on Twitter, of course. So enough of that interesting stuff. We have some session objectives for you. We have a lot of stuff, so we're going very fast through this slides. Because it's a deep dive session, we won't show you how to create a storage space. We will talk about how the things work under the hood. And this is the only one marketing slide, which is Carsten's part.
Why is that marketing? Okay, Microsoft has a new vision for IaaS, Infrastructure as a Service, and of course, virtualization is in place, and what should Microsoft prefer other than Hyper-V, of course? So we have Hyper-V. Then, if you have a Hyper-V or a cluster, you need storage, and for the storage subsystem, there is the Scaleout file server. And beneath the Scaleout file server, Microsoft would like to see storage spaces. We come to block storage later, please. And not only one JBOD here, maybe 3 or 4 of them. And between the Scaleout file server and your Hyper-V hosts, there is a great protocol called SMB3. Maybe you know SMB from the past. It's when a client connects to a file server. There is a new version, started with 2012. Now in 2012 R2, we have a slightly newer version. We will talk about that later. And then Microsoft says, okay, we have a nice management solution for all of that. It's System Center 2012 R2. And the vision is you can manage all of this Hyper-V cluster, scale-out file server cluster, JBots with System Center. So you have a solution, one solution, one vendor strategy, and we will talk about that a little bit later. So you will start now with storage spaces. Also?
Yeah, just a small quote. Who is aware of the white paper EMC released last year claiming that SMB is the future storage protocol? A few hands. Okay. This is quite interesting, isn't it? Because they are integrating SMB3 now into their traditional NAS storage devices. And SMB3, of course, is not feature complete on third-party products right now. But I guess we will see that coming up in the next years. So storage spaces. I searched a definition for storage spaces in Wikipedia. I didn't find anything. Then I asked a few fellow MEPs, how would you describe this technology? And that was the result. So physical disk plugged into enclosures aggregated to logical pools hosting virtual disks. Makes that sense?
Yeah.
Hope so. So this is, I'm not selling data on JBots here, but in fact, this is what we are at Idenetics, what we are using mostly right now. We are using data on JBots, and this is a JBot. This is just an enclosure with some disks, no RAID controller, as you know, which if you are already using storage spaces. We have a storage pool. This is like a logical aggregation of all the physical disks in this or in multiple enclosures, of course. And on the storage pool, we are creating called spaces or virtual disks. Of course, we can have multiple virtual disks on a single pool. We can have multiple pools. And this, of course, is managed through the Cloud OS or through Server 2012 R2. It has started with 2012, but 2012 R2 got more features like storage tiering, which we will take care in a few minutes. So storage spaces under the hood, there are a lot of things we could talk about, but I picked up those four pillars: resiliency levels, enclosure awareness, tiering, columns, and rebuild stuff. So how this stuff works under the hood, Carsten.
So we can talk maybe 2 or 3 hours about storage spaces. So if you have questions after the session, we will be downstairs
at the... Yeah, I will be at the Ask the Experts booth for about 12 hours from now.
Okay. No. So if there are questions left, and I guess there are, we have only 60 minutes.
Yes.
Come to us. We love to talk about storage spaces and scale-out files. So
resiliency levels. We have three main resiliency levels, meaning how much data copies we have, how much physical disks we can lose. There is a simple space. Hopefully, never, ever you're going to using a simple space in production, neither in test or dev. If you're losing a single disk, then you're done. Your data's lost. The mirror space creates 2 or 3 data copies of each block which is written to the space. So in this situation, we have 8 disks with a dual mirror on top of that, meaning first data is written to the first 4 disks, and the copy is, in the meantime, written to the second part of the space. So the parity space is comparable to a RAID 5 or a RAID 5 with dual parity, meaning this is a RAID 6, I guess. We have single parity or dual parity spaces. So what we are using here is fault tolerance and, mainly resiliency. The outage you can afford with a single enclosure and the mirror space, multiple enclosures, multiple data copies. This is a table to take home, to think about it. But what you have to know is if you lose a single disk in a two-way mirror, you're still good, but you're degraded. So if you can afford it, create a three-way mirror. Don't create parity spaces for virtual machine workloads. Parity spaces are lightning fast for reading, but crappy slow for writing. So for traditional virtual machine workloads, always create mirror spaces. 2 or 3-way mirror if you can afford it. Losing.
I would say 3-way mirror if you can't afford it.
Well, I would go for three-way mirror.
Yeah.
Agree. If you have multiple storage stamps and you use Hyper-V replica, then you might go with a two-way mirror. Does anybody already know what enclosure awareness is exactly? Some hands, okay. Enclosure awareness is something third-party storage vendors usually don't have in this price segment. It ensures that if you have a data copy, the second data copy, meaning the mirror copy, is not stored on the same enclosure. So storage spaces ensures that if you're writing data twice, the data is written on two different enclosures. That means if you are losing one enclosure, you're still good. You have no data loss. If you have a three-way mirror, you're good to lose another disk. And what we have seen in the field is sometimes you can also lose three or four disks, and nothing happens. That's because you're not really aware where your data lives. Might be that if you lose another enclosure, your data is not affected.
Yeah. Maybe it's a best practice session. Maybe we have to add storage enclosure. You have to enable enclosure awareness. If you have three or four enclosure, you may assume that when you create a space, it's already enclosure aware. That's not the case.
Yeah.
You have to use a PowerShell commandlet to enable the enclosure awareness.
Yeah. What I do usually is enable enclosure awareness default setting on the storage pool. So for every virtual disk you're creating afterwards, it's created by default with enclosure awareness equals true. So that's so you won't forget to enable it space by space then. Storage tiering, introduced with 2012 R2. Exactly two tiers, not three, not four. We have two tiers. We have an SSD tier and an HDD tier. We also have a write-back cache. Everything is block-based, so the write-back cache takes random write spikes, sucks them up, and puts them back to the HDD tier afterwards. If I search for an animation to illustrate that, the red bullets are the hot data, the blue bullets are the so-called cold data, which is not very frequently accessed, which has not a random characteristic. So what happens? Storage spaces has a scheduled task which runs by default at 1 o'clock in the morning and recalculates which blocks are hot, which blocks are cold, and then it moves around the affected blocks. To SSD tier, from SSD tier, back to HDD tier, and vice versa.
Important is move, not copy.
Move, yeah.
So your blocks are in the hot area or in the cold area, not in both.
So the space number two, I wanted to illustrate the write-back cache there. So we have a small portion of hot data which is sucked up by the write-back cache living on the SSD tier side and then written back to the HDD tier. How many times can I run the storage optimization tasks to run this functionality? That's a question I always get from the customers. There's a best practice level, 6 hours, every 6 hours. You might run it manually if you're putting a lot of data in migration scenarios. You might run manually by command. But in a regular base, I would also recommend not to go below every 6 hours. It's just because usually your productive workloads, they don't change in a manner that you have to run this task every hour. That's just the case. Any questions on tiering right now? OK, this is a task running at 1 a.m. in the morning. Of course, you're supposed to change that. Of course, you can create multiple schedules, whatever. It's just the schedule task just executes defrag.exe with some special switches introduced in 2012 R2.
And it's at 1 a.m. in the morning. Microsoft assumes that there is not a lot of going on your storage at 1 a.m. in the morning. That maybe is not true when you do backup.
Might not be true for everyone, right?
Yeah. And the tiering operation is quite expensive because the blocks are copied from the HDDs to the SSDs over the servers. So there is a lot of going on at that time.
Yeah.
And maybe there is a better time than 1 a.m. in the morning.
Also consider the fact that if the storage optimization job runs, your performance is also a little bit gets a little bit degraded. It's not that heavy, but your performance is not as you would expect if the job is not running. So it degrades the overall performance of the system, so be careful to run it every minute. What we can see here in this picture is just an output of defrog.exe/g/u, which outputs the actual status of the tiering situation.
And you don't see that normally.
You don't see that normally. Yeah, the task in task manager runs silently and doesn't output anything like this. My fellow storage freak has created a script which outputs the outcome of this task into a log file where you can centrally then see what's happening with every optimization task.
Over the time, because normally you don't see that, and it's very valuable to see how many data is in SSD and how many is in HDD. And but you will explain what we see there.
Yeah, this example here is a really bad one. If you have this situation, you will have pain. Because what does that mean? The current size of the faster SSD tier is now about 1.5 terabyte.
That's not so bad.
That's not too bad. But to serve 100% of your actual IOPS, or the IOPS since the last scan, you should have 2.5 terabyte. Meaning that if you're on a percentage of IOS, total IOS service by the SSD tier with 87%, you might have a slow experience already. We will talk about scalability or sizing a little bit later on. And that goes down and down and down. Yes, question? Okay, the question was, how long does an optimization job run usually? It depends on the change you have from hot to cold. And you want to talk about that?
You can get a feeling how much data is moved. There are event logs that say, okay, I will move such and such many data to SSD and from SSD to HDD. In my script, I also have these event logs added to the log file. So there Microsoft states in the storage space something event log, how much it will move or has moved, or how much it want to move and how much it actually moves,
so the
and
fact
how
is,
long the job takes. So you can see that.
But the fact is, we are not able to tell you an answer about that. You have to test your workloads. You have to see how many changes you have on your traditional balanced day-by-day workload scenario, how many data is changing into a hot situation and how many data is changing to a cold. So test before it go production. There are some values which are like kind of a hard fact. If you are on 1% of the SSD tier accounted to the total amount of storage capacity you have, you're not good. So 8% SSD compared to the total amount of storage would be a good number, also conferred by Microsoft as a best practice. So 8% SSD from the total capacity would be okay.
But this is quite expensive.
Yeah.
Because if you think, normally we use nearline ZAS disks, 4 terabyte or so on. These are big ones, and they are a little bit slower than normal ZAS HDDs, like 15K or 10K, but use the slower ones and then have some SSDs. And 8%, if you maybe have 100 terabyte of slow performer, I would call them, you need 8 terabyte of SSDs, and that's not cheap. Because you can't use SATA SSDs, you have to use ZAS SSDs, Enterprise ZAS SSDs.
Yeah? And they are still not cheap. Of course, a lot cheaper than buying the SSDs from a third-party vendor, but still expensive.
Yeah.
Columns. A column represents a single physical disk in a pool, right?
You learned that, huh?
Oh, I tried it 100 times, but this is the truth. One column is a single physical disk in the pool. The interleave is a chunk size of a data stripe. So, meaning if you're writing 1 megabyte to the storage space, the default interleave is 256 KB is the default interleave value. So, meaning 1 megabyte is divided to 4 chunks written to the storage space. A stripe is the native data stripe, meaning the 1 megabyte. Sometimes this is confusing if you see storage space best practice documents. It's getting mixed up, interleave and stripe size and block file system block size. This, sometimes it gets mixed up. So how does that look like? In this example, I have a two-column, two-way mirror. So two columns. I'll explain that in a second. Two data copies. So every data which is written twice. Two columns means this 512K, which are written to the storage space right now, they are divided into two chunks of 256KB and written to the first two disks. In the meantime, they are written to the second two disks, achieving the data copy, the resiliency level. I try to illustrate that here. So the first two pieces are written to the first two disks, and the data copy to the second two disks. So, meaning, if in a two-column scenario, you could say that if something is written to the space, two columns at a time are active. So, how many IOPS we get from a 10K SAS HDD drive?
Oh.
200? 180?
Around 200. So, maybe 250.
So, almost nothing, right?
Yeah.
But that is not the whole truth. So, if you would just have two columns, your storage space would not write any data in a certain amount of time. There is a parallelity, meaning the second block of data which is coming in is then written in an almost parallel manner to the second, to the fifth disk and sixth disk and seven and eight disk and so on. Mm-hmm. So your storage space is writing on a parallel manner to all the disks which are in the storage pool. That's why we create the pools as large as we can, as large as it is supported, right? Yeah.
You have some numbers for the performance, huh?
Yeah.
How to calculate it?
How do you calculate a maximum performance in terms of columns you have in your pool? I'm not explaining that right now. You can read it afterwards. It's just a single math. It's simple to calculate your performance you should expect from your storage pool.
And we have it later at the best practices, but the default interleave size with 256 kilobyte is too large for virtualization. Microsoft says if you use virtualization, use 64 kilobyte interleaves and also format NTFS, the NTFS file system on top of that with 64 kilobytes. We have that later in our best practices.
And when you want to talk about the rebuild quickly?
No.
No? Okay, then.
It's your slide.
If something fails, which doesn't happen very often, but something happens here, a disk is failing. With 2012 R2, they introduced a parallel rebuild model, meaning you are not forced to have spare disks anymore. You're not forced. You might still use spare disks, but you can also use the parallel rebuild mode, meaning you just leave enough space spare space on your pool, letting the system restoring the failed data from multiple disks at a time. So if you have a spare disk, you just lose performance of this disk, right? If this spare disk has to be rebuilt, it will not be rebuilt from a from multiple disks at a time. It takes the data and rebuilds the single disk, okay? If we have the parallel rebuild mechanism, the data is being rebuilt on this left spare space of the storage pool. We have a faster rebuild process because the data is regenerated from multiple disks at a time.
Yeah.
There are some drawbacks.
I would tell them. Okay. The rebuild process has such a high priority. Storage spaces rebuild as fast as they can. That could impact your workload. So if the rebuild is going on, storage space is very fast, very aggressive with a rebuild. So if you have VMs, for example, they didn't get enough I/O to perform well.
Yeah.
So test this, pull out a disk, see how the rebuild impacts your workloads. So maybe it's better to use hot spares. It depends on your environment. Or don't use parallel rebuild. There is also a possibility on the pool to do a sequential rebuild.
We have to be honest. There is actually no way to tear down the rebuild process. So there is no prioritization magic. You can tear down the rebuild process beside switching to a sequential rebuild mode, meaning one after the other, which the rebuild process then increases significantly, but you will not have that much performance impact. Best practice?
We don't have one.
It depends.
Yeah. Will you do that? We are already half an hour into the...
Yeah, we have half an hour. I just said I don't want to show how to create a storage space. If you want to see the storage space tiering in action in detail, what happens on the physical disks, let's move that to the Ask the Experts booth. I can show you if you like.
Yeah.
We have so much other things with SMB3 and scale-up file server that time is just not enough to do funny performance demos right now.
Yeah. Maybe we have time at the end. Now I take the SMB3 part.
SMB3. Is this a fiber channel version 3 or?
No, it's not. It's the old SMB protocol. Normally I ask if you know when Microsoft started to use something like SMB. We don't have the time, so it's 20 years ago with Windows for Workgroups 3.11, they started with this protocol. It's not called SMB there, but we are now at this third major version, and there are a lot of enhancements. I can't talk about all of them, but I have some highlights here. One is SMB Direct. One goal of SMB was when they did SMB 3.0 to be comparable in performance with Fiber Channel, with the latency of Fiber Channel and with the performance, and they did very well. With SMB Direct, we will talk about that later in another slide, you have the possibility to be even faster than Fiber Channel, have lower latencies than Fiber Channel, and there are possibilities on one port to use 56 gigabit per second on one port. And there are other things in SMB, like SMB multi-channel. You don't have to stop at one port with 56 gigabit. You can have more 56 gigabit ports, so you can have maybe a storage system with 100 gigabit if the storage system can take the load.
Yeah.
Multi-channel, we will talk about that. There is something in there. If you have Hyper-V or SQL Server, there is a transparent failover. If a storage system fails or a file server fails, I will show that in a video later, there is a transparent failover to the other node and your workload has stopped the I/O for a bit and then it will go on and there is no data lost. And if you are security sensitive, there's also an encryption mechanism in SMB3. It's built in, you have only to turn it on, and then an SMB3 client and an SMB3 server will do encryption on the wire. It's not IPsec, it's much easier. You have only to turn it on if you want to.
It's data encryption in transition with an overhead of about 1%.
Yeah. So SMB Direct or SMB over RDMA. RDMA stands for Remote Direct Memory Access. We have two RNICs, RDMA NICs, and the client and the server are talking over these RDMA NICs, and there is no TCP/IP involved. TCP/IP is a very heavy stack in the networking. So if you can bypass TCP/IP, you have much less CPU usage. In fact, the TCP/IP stack is normally rendered for a connection on one core. There's no parallelism in the TCP/IP stack. So with one TCP/IP connection, you are you can only transfer maybe 5 to 6 gigabit per second.
You're limited to 4.7 gigabytes per second.
I've seen more, slightly more, maybe 5 gigabit. So TCP/IP can't go faster in one connection than 5 gigabit in Windows. And that's a bottleneck. Here we have, with this RDMA NICs, we have the possibility to get 56 gigabit with InfiniBand. And there is a lot of information here. Maybe this is important. We have three flavors of RDMA. We have two with Ethernet, that's IWAP and Rocky, and I will talk about that a little bit later, and InfiniBand. And we can do multi-channel with RDMA, so you have all the possibilities that SMB brings to the table also with RDMA NICs. Is something else important on this slide? Everything is important, but maybe the minimal CPU utilization for I/O processing, because these cards are doing the job, not your CPU. Yeah. I have another slide. Here we see a client and a server communicating over RDMA. Can I show it here? Can you see this red dot there? So we have our application, maybe Hyper-V. He wants to talk, or the application wants to talk with the server, with a VHDX. There is the data with Hyper-V stored. So the application doesn't know that the stack will use RDMA. The SMB client decides if he uses the RDMA path or the TCP/IP path. And these RDMA NICs can do TCP/IP. These are normal NICs, and they can do RDMA. If both sides have RDMA, they use RDMA. If one side has an RDMA NIC and the other side only a TCP/IP NIC, they do TCP/IP. So this client decides to use SMB Direct, and there is a very small protocol here. It's not the big TCP/IP stack, and then there is a very fast transfer of the data to the other side. So the client and the server negotiates if they use RDMA or if they use TCP/IP. Both is possible over these cards.
So RDMA is the short term for remote direct memory access, meaning you could explain it like one card is writing to the other card's memory directly with skipping the TCP/IP stack.
The server is pulling the memory out of the client without the Windows server doing much. Yep. The CPU is not doing much. So these are the three flavors of RDMA or SMB Direct cards. There's IWAP. This is the most complex one. There is a whole TCP/IP stack on the card. So IWAP is TCP/IP, but in the card. The Windows server and the client does RDMA, so very, very fast, but the card has a complete TCP/IP stack on it. Therefore, IWAP is rootable. If you want to route your storage traffic through your network with IWAP, this is possible. And many people know TCP/IP, so they know how this works. There's in the moment only one vendor who is doing IWAP. It's Chelsea. There are other vendors talking about it, but it's maybe too early to say who is
coming. To be honest, Chelsea and Mellanox are the only one to go right now.
Oh, that you do.
That's my opinion, yes.
So IWAP is TCP, IP, and it's using Ethernet, your normal Ethernet network, 10 gigabit or 40 gigabit or whatever you have, 25 gigabit is coming, 100 gigabit is coming. You can use your normal Ethernet switches. You don't have to have special switches. You can do IWAP. The other flavor that's using Ethernet is RoCE. It stands for RDMA over converged Ethernet, and there's this converged Ethernet in it. So this is pure Ethernet protocol. There is no TCP IP involved. The server is doing RDMA, and the NICs are doing Ethernet. It's much like fiber channel over Ethernet. Who of you is, quick show of hands, who is using fiber channel over Ethernet in production? Okay.
At least 4 or 5 hands.
Yeah. This is pure Ethernet, so you have to do things like DCB on the switches and PFC, priority flow control. You have to guarantee that your traffic flows through the switches with no pauses.
It's also called lossless Ethernet.
It has to be lossless, yes, your traffic. And you have to configure your switches, and you have to have switches that supports PFC, priority flow control. So RoCE is, the cards are cheaper, but you have to have switches that support PFC. And don't do RoCE without PFC in the switches. It works great if you test your stuff, but under heavy load, there will be problems. There will be packet loss. There is no TCP IP algorithm that guarantees that your packet will be delivered to the other side and that they will be resent. That's not RoCE.
Lossless means no retransmission magic, so a lost packet is lost. So
yeah. They will, eventually the server will get it, but there are drops and the performance is bad.
In 2008 or 2, they modified the stack a little bit, so if it fails, it fails back to TCP/IP. So you don't have to be afraid of losing data. It just falls back to TCP/IP.
Yeah. And the problem is many switch vendors don't really know how to configure RoCE with fiber channel over Ethernet. This is well known. We configure it like fiber channel over Ethernet. There are more vendors. Mellanox is the most known. They have a 10 and a 40 gigabit implementation.
Mellanox.
Also, Emulex is coming, or is there. And Cisco, we have a sponsor, Cisco, here. The new VNIC also supports RoCE. So
it's pretty amazing that you can now use UCS with RDMA on a converged adapter, right?
Yeah, and Cisco will do it right with the switches because they do fiber channel over Ethernet very well. So, and the last one is InfiniBand. This is not Ethernet, it's a whole new other thing, but it's very fast and it's built, its roots are in high performance computing, and you can use that. And the amazing thing is you have 56 gigabit ports with that. And normally, I would have a price comparison here. The cards are expensive, but the InfiniBand switches are very cheap. So, in fact, the 56 gigabit InfiniBand port and switch port together are not more expensive than a 10 gigabit Ethernet port. So, if you need very fast storage, and the good thing is Windows Server. Windows Server 2012 R2 can also live migrate over SMB3. So you can live migrate in Hyper-V with memory performance. Microsoft has done that with 150 gigabit per second live migrating virtual machines from one host to another over Ethernet or InfiniBand. So it's not a bad choice. I think you have implemented InfiniBand. I normally go Ethernet way.
RoCE.
RoCE, yeah.
We have IWARP and RoCE scenarios in production.
Yeah.
I prefer RoCE. As soon as you know what you have configured on the switches, it's very easy, but it's not like InfiniBand. InfiniBand is plug and play. It's almost a no-brainer.
Yeah. But if you
RoCE
don't,
RoCE is a little bit harder to configure.
Yeah. But if you are leaving fiber channel and don't want to get into another exotic protocol, go with Ethernet, InfiniBand, Ethernet with RoCE or with IWAP. Okay, multi-channel. This is really great. Multi-channel, we have some scenarios here where multi-channel can be used. You can use multi-channel in a 110 gigabit port. There's not only one TCP/IP connection open to the server, they will do four. And these four TCP/IP connections, if we don't have RDMA, it's also very, very good for not RDMA traffic. We have four TCP/IP connections, and these four connections can be rendered, I say rendered or calculated, on four different cores. So the 5 gigabit limit for a TCP/IP connection doesn't matter here, because we have four TCP/IP connections. These can be calculated on different cores. You get the full 10 gigabit. Even multi-channel can be used with 1 gigabit switch. If you have a lot of 1 gigabit switch in your servers, you can do the storage over maybe four different ports and use multi-channel. Here is a, Here's a scenario with teaming. It also supports teaming, but I don't do teaming with multi-channel. On the storage system, I use ports on different subnets, and SMB will do the magic and use both ports. We will see that in a video later. And of course, RDMA also supports multi-channel. In this RDMA NIC, it has, here are 10 gigabit or InfiniBand or Ethernet cards with RDMA. They also do more than one channel to communicate to the other side. It is auto-configured. You don't have to do anything.
It's enabled by default.
It's enabled by default. The server and the client will figure out if a multi-channel is possible and use it. But you can say, this port I don't want to have, I don't want to use for multi-channel. So you are still able to say only these two ports for SMB traffic and the other ones for other stuff.
So for example, if you have 10 gigabit Ethernet and you have RDMA cards dedicated to the storage network, we usually create those so-called SMB multi-channel constraints to limit the multi-channel storage traffic only to the RDMA cards. But by default, every card is enabled for multi-channeling.
I will show a quick video about SMB multi-channel. This is nearly 2 years old. We have here two servers, one server with two SSDs in a RAID 1. That's my source server. And then I have a destination server with a RAM disk, with a 64 gigabyte RAM disk. And both servers have four NICs, two 1 gigabit NICs, two 10 gigabit NICs. My server has all ports enabled. On my client, I have only one gigabit port enabled here. And I copy about 52 gigabytes of data with Microsoft Explorer. I grab them and copy it to the RAM disk. And you see here, that's normal. You see 112, 140, 14 megabyte per second. That's nearly a gigabit. Sorry for the German video, but I think you get what's there. So now I enable another 1 gigabit card. And the network is doing the magic. I have here DHCP configured. That's normally not used. You use fixed IP address, but I want to show how it works with DHCP. So he gets a DHCP address. He now figures out the security profile for the firewall. Are we in a domain network or in a public network? And this takes a while. And now he has a domain network. And we see here, oh, the client and the server talks. Oh, we have now two connections. It is possible to do our transition over two connections, and it will do that. So the traffic goes up to maybe 180, 190 megabytes per second. You see here, both adapters are used. The protocol uses both adapters for one connection. And
the only thing you have to do is having multiple NICs on multiple subnets. Yeah. That's the only
So now thing. I have two 10 gigabit ports. Let's see what happens if we enable the 10 gigabit ports. And the same game here, DHCP address, network identification, what security profile should be put on this network, and I enable the second 10 gigabit port because 10 gigabit is a little bit faster than 1 gigabit, and my fear was that this copy job was finished before the second card would be there. So let's see what's happened. We are still in the... Now we have the domain network. and here should change something. So you see, we jump up to 650 megabytes per second. This is one connection between the client and the file server. And now the second card is there. We will not see more performance here, but we see here that the traffic, the load, is equally distributed over both cards. And now a question for you. Why only 650 megabytes? We could do about 2.5 gigabytes over 2 10-gig sessions. Do you know? Please? The disk, exactly. The source server has only 2 SSDs, and they can't do better than 650 megabytes per second. The limitation here are the 2 SSDs. I've done this RAMDisk to RAMDisk, you get 18 or 19 gigabits per second. Okay. If you put both things together, RDMA, NICs, and multi-channel, there is a blog post from Jose Barreto where they explain a test scenario they did at Microsoft. And we see here, we have an SMB client with 3 InfiniBand NICs with 40 gigabits. And the server has also 3 40-gigabit NICs. And our server has 10 Fusion I/O cards in it. They copy data from the SMB client to the SMB server. And SMB client is also a server. It's a protocol client. And what is the result? They copy data with 120 gigabits per second from a client to a server. If your storage system is only SSD, you can have this performance. 120 gigabits in gigabytes is 15 gigabytes per second, or I say 3 to 4 DVDs per second, are copied over the network from the client to the server. So this was the SMB3 protocol. The protocol is nothing without the file server. And you can have great performance on your file server. You have Hyper-V hosts using your file server as data store. But if there's only one file server, you have a single point of failure. So Microsoft has a high available file server, and it's called scale-out file server in this scenario. We have here 4 file servers, and we have our storage there. We can have up to 8 file server nodes that are where you can spread the load. There is 1 file system namespace on these file servers. We have one share. That share is presented on every file server actively. Of course, you can have more than one share, but this one share or every share is presented on every file server. It's an active scenario. We can connect our Hyper-V machines or our SQL servers through SMB over TCP or RDMA, that doesn't matter. And we can connect a single Hyper-V host or single Hyper-V nodes and cluster or clusters to the same share. They can use the same data store, cluster nodes and single Hyper-V nodes. Not like in a block storage scenario where you can use the Loon only in a cluster and not from a second cluster, the same Loon, or from standalone systems. That's not possible. With SMB3, that is possible with a scale-out file server. And we have block storage or, like Michael said, storage spaces. You have the choice. So what is, if you have traditional SAN storage system, you can use a scale-out file server. Up to eight of them. We have some great features, and it's called CSV read cache. Is supported in a block storage scenario with a scale-out file server. What does CSV read cache mean? You say, on my file server, maybe 16 gigabytes are read cache. And when he reads the data from the block storage, he puts the data in the read cache. And if this data is more than one used, it put it in another half of the read cache, and then it's in memory. So if a client says, I need this block, it's delivered from the read cache of the file server and not pulled from the SAN system. So you have great performance here. And this is a very cool scenario if you do VDI and have a golden image, for example. If your golden image fits in the read cache, the read IOs of your virtual machines is delivered from memory, not from your SAN storage.
One thing to mention here, you cannot combine storage tiering with CSV read cache. So either you have storage tiers or read cache. But the only thing you can do then is pin your virtual parent disk file in a fixed manner to the SSD tier. So yeah. This is also supported.
Yeah. Read cache is even faster than SSD because yep. there's SAS involved. But here's the other scenario. We do our scale-out file server with JBots and with tiering. And like you said, there is no possibility in this scenario for a read cache. We can have up to 4 file servers practically because you have to connect every file server through SAS to your storage systems. And on the JBots, you have not infinite SAS ports. The most I know are 8 ports. And if you want to do MPIO, connect more than one SAS port to your server for redundancy, you are practically limited to 4 nodes. So this is much cheaper, of course, than block storage. And I have another demo here, how a scale-out file server, how it is with resiliency. So I started. We have here a virtual machine with IO meta running. And I show you that this disk is on a share. SOFS stands for scale-out file server. So the data of this virtual machine is presented through a share that is presented to a scale-out file server. You see now the scale-out file server, the 2 nodes, and I drain one node. So everything this node is presenting is now moved to the second server. And you see that everything, the disks, the spaces, the server itself, the leading node, is everything is now on file server 2. And
without
then
an interruption,
I unpause the file server 1, and a friend of mine, a Microsoft evangelist from Germany, we are doing IT camps and show that live. He is, I think, appearing in. Where is he? There he is.
Hi, Bernard.
This is Bernard, and he will pull the plugs out of file server 2, who is doing all the things now in 1 second. This is the monitor you see. The I/O of the virtual machine drops to 0. And now the scale-out file server is doing the magic. You see the clock there. We have pulled the power at 20 seconds here, and we see the clock there. And now the I/O is back after 22 seconds. Everything is running smoothly. And there is no data loss. Your virtual machine can't write to the disk, but there is no data lost. So in 22 seconds, your storage system is up and running. Every VM can work now with the disk on the other system. And pulling the power out of your file server is the worst that can happen. It's like a blue screen or a power outage on the server. So we have some field notes left. We have 5 minutes still.
5 minutes left, yeah, that should be good for going through all the most important things.
Yeah, first one.
Don't use consumer hardware.
Don't
use
do that.
Enterprise stuff, meaning from end to end. Not go to Amazon and buy your SSDs there, the cheapest one. You will be head of with pain.
Yes. Next one.
Next one. No SAS chaining. So there is this funny concept of creating a daisy chain for the SAS bus.
Thomas,
connect your JBots, if you're using storage spaces, connect them directly from each file server node with 2 active paths to each JBot.
Yeah.
We have seen weird scenarios with daisy chaining. And as I said, you have to plan your capacity. So how much SSD you have to buy? Analyze your workloads as they are right now. How many IOs you have in which manner, how many random writes, random reads, or sequential writes you have on your workloads. Then you can better design your capacity, meaning the tiering, whatever you need here.
Maybe you use the Microsoft Assessment and Planning Toolkit to see how the IO is in your environment.
Yeah.
You can measure it with the Map Toolkit.
Yeah.
This is one from me. There is the Windows Server Catalog, and they have a part where storage spaces hardware is tested. And only use stuff that is presented here. Only use that. We have experience with customers who don't use the stuff that is here, and there is a lot of pain involved if you put your hardware together without these tests that are done.
We learned it the hard way, right?
We have a lot of pain, especially with SSDs. So if one thing you have to put from this, that are the SSDs. Don't go with SSDs that are not on the hardware list, believe us. And have the firmware in the SSDs that's here supported. So,
yeah, just go quickly through. 4 or 8 columns are best. Don't go with 7 or 5 or 9 columns. Your performance will be crap. Use 64K interleave for virtual machine workloads. Leave the 1 GB write-back cache. Don't exceed it to 20 gigabytes. Your HDD disks will not be happy writing all the incoming cached IOs back to the HDD disks. There is a maximum of 80 disks per a single pool, and there is a maximum of 4 pools per cluster. So that's kind of, you can imagine where the maximum is for your storage stamp. So if you have to scale out, create other stamps in the same manner.
Yeah. The 80 disks are if you have a high available file server. If you look at the internet, at Microsoft numbers, per pool there are 240 disks. But if you have a scale out file server and have a high availability solution, and you only want that, I assume, 80 disks per pool, 4 pools per server. That is still 240 disks.
It's still very a lot, very high capacity and density you can create there, yeah.
So this is the number we pulled up from Microsoft, 8% SSD. Your SSD tier, 8%, you should be fine. If you calculate it, maybe 4% are more affordable. Huh?
This is not a hard fact. Again, analyze your workloads so you can better calculate your average you should have on the SSD tier.
Then the rebuild process, we said before, is very aggressive. So test it and think about it. Microsoft's recommendation is parallel rebuild. Don't use hot spares. I am not so sure what I'm doing in the moment at customers. But I'm tending back to hot spares. But this is my personal flavor, and I'm not really sure about it.
I'm still in the transition.
You are in the transition, okay. If you use MPIO, if you connect more than one ZAS cable to your JBOD, you have to configure MPIO, and then there is the failover policy. Don't use round robin. This is the normal stuff. Use failover only. We have seen really weird things with round robin. So use two cables, but use failover only. And the last one, it's very, very, very important. Test, test, and test. This is not something you buy from your ZAN vendor and everything is fine. You pull together your stuff. It's much, 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 much cheaper, but it's not one vendor you buy your solution. Windows Server is a storage system. You may have data on JBODs. You may have Aztec SSDs. You may have Seagate HDDs. You may have LSI controllers and so on. Test it.
If you want to have some practice guidelines, which hardware you should take, pick up us down at the booth. We can talk about our experience with different hardware types.
Yeah. Question and answer. We will be down.
We are out of time, unfortunately.
Yeah. So ask us after the session.
Pick up us at the booth or later on or at the party or whatever.
And please give feedback. At least you know there is a charity involved with your feedback. A half Schweizer Franken is...
Well, half a dollar, half a euro, whatever. Okay.
So thank you for your attendance here and have a nice last day at the System Center Universe.
Thanks.